This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Check out my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper. I would like to hear from you. If you have an author that you would like me to invite, just let me know and I will do it. And then while you're there, friend me and I will friend you. I am so happy today to welcome to Joy on Paper one of my favorite writers, and I am excited to talk about her new book, Lisa Unger. Hi, Lisa, are you there?
I'm here, Patsy. Hi.
Oh, wow. It is wonderful to talk to you. Your new book, The Red Hunter, is an amazing psychological thriller.
Thank you.
It's really good.
Thank you.
Now, you know, I not only did I read the book, what I wanted to do, because I have recently become really appreciative of audible
yeah.
books. And so I got the Audible book, and I thought that the narrator, Julia Whalen, did a fantastic job.
Yeah, she really did. And sometimes it's, I mean, I've been lucky because I've had a number of really amazing audiobook actors do the narrative, and it's amazing what they bring to it. So I really enjoyed her performance. It's really terrific.
Now tell us a little bit about The Red Hunter. I'm always like a little worried about telling too much, but one of the things that I wanted to say in this book, you know, you broke one of the rules of Elmer Leonard of no prologue. I think that's his rule number two. But I thought,
yeah, a lot of people have that rule, but I love a good prologue.
Me too. I love a good prologue. And I mean, when a book needs it, it needs it. And this one, this is one of the most, as I was reading this prologue, I could feel like my fingers tingling because it was so exciting. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. And I'm just, right there, I said, oh, thank goodness, this prologue is amazing.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a little bit of a rule breaker. You know, I believe that rules are great until you want to do something different.
Exactly.
And I love a prologue because, you know, for me, I think it just, it brings you right into a moment in time. You know, storytelling is not always linear. I mean, at least not the way I do it. So, you know, it's like these sort of intense moments when they appear to you. And often that's like sort of my first moment when I like start hearing a character voice or have a thought or like a vibe or a feeling. Like it's usually like one, you know, distinct voice or moment. And so I tend to just leap in right where I, you know, first start hearing a character. And that just happened to be where I started hearing that particular character. So, you know, it's one of my things.
Well, you know, of course, when we're talking about character with you, I was thinking about how you write. And it reminds me of a few weeks ago, I was watching the Great British Bake Off, and they were making a cake, like little thin layer after another. Mm. And that's, you know, I think they landed up with 27 layers. And that's sort of like your characters. They are so... you give us one, then I layer it on top and layer it on top, and they become so fantastic. You're a wonderful writer, especially from the character point of view. And as a matter of fact, I know Ace Atkins, who's going to be on the program in a few weeks. He's a great admirer of yours, and he talks about how you develop characters.
Oh, that's so nice. He's actually, you know, I've been a longtime fan of Ace, and, you know, feel blessed to call him my friend. So that means a lot to me. And, you know, we're all sort of comprised of at least 27 layers, aren't we? You know, and that's how we get to know each other as people. You know, you meet somebody and you know a little bit about that person and then a little bit more. And as your relationship deepens, you know, get to see all the different layers. And I have that same relationship to my characters. you know, I see them, you know, they evolve for me on the page very much in the way that they're evolving for the reader. So, you know, I like to discover my characters and, you know, and dive into my relationship with them. And hopefully that gives an authentic experience to the reader as well.
Well, this book is wonderful. Tell, I will let you tell as much as you want to tell, because I don't want to give away some stuff, but tell us about The Red Hunter. And it's a wonderfully told story about two women who have faced horrific experiences.
Right. So we have two women, and they've both been the victims of traumatic events in their life, very dark moments, and they both survived. One of them was a young girl, Zoe Drake, when she, you know, her life just exploded in a nightmare. And the other woman, Claudia Bishop, a bit older, when her life similarly was blown to smithereens by a violent crime. And after these events in each of their lives, they each chose a very different path. Claudia is kind of white-knuckling her way toward the light and forgiveness. And you know, she's on sort of a spiritual journey, and she's, you know, she has a blog, and she's a restoring an old house, and she's, you know, got all these metaphors in her life for, you know, expressing and rebuilding and trying to find a new life for herself. Zoe, on the other hand, very young, sometime after her event, she discovers the martial arts. And as she's learning about herself and about her body and about her physical strength, she winds up experiencing a second event, which introduces her to her own power. She stops something bad from happening and creates a little damage in the process. And in fact, she finds that she likes it. And so she gets the idea that in order for her to heal, she's not necessarily looking for forgiveness. She's looking for revenge. So they have two very different ways of handling these traumatic moments in their lives. And it sprang from a place of interest that I had and, you know, this sort of central question of the book, which is, what is the difference between justice and revenge? And I think in our culture, often, you know, the journey to justice is, you know, it's seen as sort of a hero's journey. But is it, you know, is it really? So that's kind of the question I'm asking with this book, and, you know, just sort of exploring these two women and their very different paths and how those paths converge in a very unlikely place.
And you tell the story in two different voices. Zoe, of course, is in first person.
Yes.
And how do you like, writing the two different voices?
I don't really, there's not a lot of choice involved for me in my process. You know, people ask that question a lot. How did you choose to tell the story this way? And I don't actually have access to that part of my process, which is strange to say. You know, Zoe, you know, some of the voice, you know, her voice is in first person. Most of the other voices are in third person, omniscient. And I don't have a reason for choosing that, except that that is how each individual story presented itself to me. And I like the intimacy of a first-person narrative. I really enjoy that closeness to the character, because you're really deep inside that person. But I also enjoy the third-person omniscient, because it allows me to create a mosaic. You know, I think all life and experiences and all of our different stories are comprised of all these tiny different little parts. And that, you know, most stories are not fully told unless they're told from multiple perspectives. So I think that that's part of the reason why, you know, this book had all these different little pieces and parts of people in their moment. And there are a number of books of mine that are told that way, you know, somebody in first person and then a lot of other voices in third person. Of course, I also have novels that are fully first person. And it's not you know, there's so much leverage and latitude and flexibility in each different voice that I couldn't choose a favorite, but, you know, it just sort of evolves as the story evolves, or becomes
available. Well, I think it works perfect. It works perfectly. As a matter of fact, you know, there was for a long time, there was this rule, oh, you shouldn't do first person. That's for romance authors.
No rules, Cassie, no more rules.
Exactly. Well, I agree because one of my favorite authors is Nelson DeMille, and he is a master at alternating first person and third person. That's why his books just are such a joy to read. And I love it. I think in a way, it's almost like Zoe is taking over part of this book. And I mean, that's it. She is going to tell her story one way or another, and we're going to listen to it. And it gives an excitement to the book, I think, that it would not have if it was all third person.
And I think it's interesting with Zoe too, is that, you know, and how I felt when I was handling her is that, you know, she's so powerful. She's a powerful character. She's a powerful person, but she's also really naive and just very like sort of vulnerable and reckless. So you kind of never really, I felt like I was never really sure what she was capable of doing. And even as her journey progressed, I wasn't sure where she was going to wind up, you know, because there's a saying in the book, is sort of a Zen proverb that says, you know, if you seek revenge, dig two graves, one of them for yourself.
Well,
and I was concerned about, you know, where she might end up at the end of the book.
Well, I think we all are, you know, that's what makes the book, as I said, from the prologue on. This is, you know, we talk about a page turner. This is a page turner, and I'm thinking, oh, I don't want this book to end so fast because, you know, sometimes you just move so it just moves so fast, and it is wonderfully done.
Thank you.
Well, of course, I love you know, so many of your books. You're such a great writer, and it must be, well, it's exciting. I mean, think about it. You're translated into so many languages, and you've sold so many millions of books now. It's pretty great, isn't it?
It's a dream come true. You know, I feel enormously grateful. I never wanted to do anything else with my life. I've been a writer since I was, you know, really young. And I never ever felt more at home anywhere than I did in the telling of a story. And it's, you know, in my entire education and all my effort, you know, in my life has been towards this goal. I mean, there hasn't been anything else. So I feel really blessed to be able to, you know, make a living doing what I love. I think it's, you know, just a tremendous gift.
And, you know, at Simon & Schuster, of course, Mary Higgins Clark is the queen of suspense.
Of course.
But I think perhaps they have to crown you the Duchess of Suspense because
I'll take it.
You take it because really, and take it and run with it because
exactly.
You know, you are really, I have noticed, and I, you know, you get better. You get
Thank
better.
You.
I think
I do try. I do try. That is my goal.
Well, I think that, you know, we, again, people put you know, books into a certain genre, and that's it. But you're on the edge of that. You know, it's not just that you're a suspense writer. You're writing such depth and emotion, human emotion and human tragedies and human problems that I consider this literature. It's not just,
you.
You know, it's not. You know, it's a big, you've taken on a big theme here in all of your books. And I think that shows through.
Well, thank you. I think that, you know, I think that most of us, you writers, when we sit down to write, you know, we're not really choosing genre. You know, we haven't really, you know, decided what our story is or what we're trying to tell. I mean, that is something that generally comes later in many cases. And I think, you know, if you look at crime fiction, I think that some of the people, you know, some of the best people writing today are writing crime fiction. I mean, you don't have to look any further than Laura Lippman or Ace Atkins or Dennis Lehane or, you know, any of these, you know, sort of big writers that have chosen to write about crime. I don't think that there's any lack of just enormous talent within, you know, that category of fiction, trying to like stay away from, you know, the word genre because it's so heavy and has, you know, so much stigma. And I think that, you know, there's so much talent. And I think, you know, when people write about crime, you know, when you write about these kind of extreme circumstances, you know, they become like a, you know, a crucible for your character. And it's where, you know, people are revealed on these bad days, these horrible days. These are the days that reveal who we truly are as people. And I think that's why, you know, some great writers turn to crime fiction. And, you know, much of it is, you know, sort of crossing the line into, you know, general fiction, literary fiction. I mean, a lot of people are writing really well. And I think that it would be a mistake if you were the type of person, and you do meet these people like, oh, I never read mystery, I never read that kind of thing. I think you'd be, you know, really limiting yourself, you know, and not being able to discover some amazing writers if you thought that way.
And as you said, in this book, it is a question of justice and revenge. And this is a deep question throughout literature. And so it's,
of course,
I think it works beautifully. Now, I have to take a quick break. When I come back, I want you to hold on. Please hold on. When I come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about The Hollows and novellas, and about your experience in the publishing world, and also about your husband. Because I understand your husband comes from Detroit, and I come from Detroit.
Okay.
Okay? So hold on. We're going to play a song for Texas so that everybody can think about Texas today. And I hope everyone will go and donate to Red Cross or Samaritan's Purse or some organization that will be helping the people in Texas. So we'll listen to a few minutes of that, then we'll go to commercials, and we'll be back with Lisa Unger, New York Times bestselling author.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose.
Mike is offering 50% off his 4-pack special.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-871-1543 and use the promo code PATSY, and Mike will offer you free shipping. Once again, that's 800-871-1543, promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
The stars at night are big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas. The prairie sky is wide and high, deep in the heart of Texas.
Okay, and this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Lisa Unger, New York Times bestselling author, and her new book, of course, is just It's going to be another bestseller. I am sure of that. And it is called The Red Hunter. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, well, I'm so happy that you joined me today. On Tuesday, I almost lost my guest. It was Susan Wiggs, whose new book is called A Map of the Heart. And she had been at a conference in Austin when all of this and she got out just in time. And my nephew lives in Victoria, Texas, and he is still there. And yeah, they are just having a awful time.
Oh, that's horrible.
It is terrible. And it's also sad, you know, what these people are going through. And one of the things my nephew, luckily he's not underwater or anything, but they have no electricity. And so luckily he loves to read, and his books are safe, and so he can read because there's no television, there's nothing, and no video games. So, but all of our, you know, all of us have to just think about these people, and I hope that everyone will donate to one of the charities that are, you know, helping out there.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, you know, I wanted to, before I get on to, I want to talk to you about your novellas, but I wanted to just find out a little bit about your husband and how you met him, because, as I said, I'm from Detroit, and I think it's really a cute story.
Well, we, you know, we've been married for 17 years this next month, actually.
Oh, okay.
And we were, I had like sort of reached this really interesting point in my life 17 years ago, where I had just sort of finished my first novel, and I wasn't really sure what to do with it. So I had shelved it, and I went to Key West to visit a friend, and while I was there at Sloppy Joe's, I met my husband, Jeff. And it was, you know, absolutely like a sort of a Shazam, love at first sight moment for both of us. Of course, he was living in Detroit at the time, and I was living in New York City. And so we had like this long distance love affair for, you know, like 6 months before he proposed. And so we just kind of, you know, went for broke. We said, okay, you know, we're just going to go wherever you get the best job. You know, I'm going to, you know, I am going to sell my home. I owned a place in Brooklyn Heights. I was working in publishing in New York City at the time. And I decided that I was going to give myself a year to finish my second novel and to sell the one that I had already written. So we just kind of, that's what we did. We went wherever he got the best job, and that was Clearwater. And we have been in the area ever since and happily married for 17 years with a young daughter.
Well, it is a wonderful, wonderful place. And of course, you know, all, especially Michiganders appreciate
he does
so I think that's a cute story, and it is true, there is such a thing as love at first sight, because I fell in love with my husband the minute I saw him. I mean, it literally, he walked in the doorway and I fell in love. And people say, well, does that really happen? But it does, doesn't it?
It does. Of course it does. Absolutely it does.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And I think if you're, some people are that maybe just not even open to that experience. You know, some people are so living in their own heads that if something like that happens, they question it too much, or they talk themselves out of it. But I think if you're like that kind of person that's like, you know, has an open heart, and, you know, you're open to these like sort of wild, beautiful experiences, you know, these magic moments, then I think that you're more available to it.
Exactly. Well, it is a wonderful feeling, and I'm glad that you found it and I have it. And
wonderful.
I think also in, you know, in your stories, there's a richness in the fact that I think you're a person who feels very deeply.
Yes.
And that, I think, comes through in your stories.
Thank you.
Now tell me, when you know, let's talk about The Hollows, because this is an interesting what you've done with The Hollows and the stories. I read the novella, The Whisper.
The Whispering Hollows.
Yeah, The Whispering Hollows. And tell us about that. Was it your idea to do novellas, or the publisher? Is it something that's sort of a trend now?
Yeah, so I am, you know, The Hollows first showed up in a book called Fragile. And Fragile was my ninth novel. And I, you know, when it first sort of appeared as the backdrop to this book, I honestly didn't think very much of it. You know, for me in that moment, it was just a town. It was like any town, really. Like that was sort of my thought of it, that, you know, it was the place where you go to be safe, where nothing bad ever happens. And of course, that's no place, because bad things happen everywhere. And so that was sort of my vibe about The Hollows when I sat down to write Fragile. And Fragile, interestingly enough, is one of my most personal books, because it's very loosely based on an event from my childhood, which is when I was 15 years old, a girl that I knew was abducted and murdered. And it was a horrific event in our town, deep and terrible tragedy. And it impacted me as a kid. And in fact, it changed me. It changed the way I saw the world. And I think it's one of the things that influenced me as a writer. And so I had tried to sort of tell the story, not the story in its entirety, but whatever the essence of it that was mine to tell. It kind of sort of shown up in various different partials and short stories over the years, but it never resolved itself into a novel until Fragile. And it was almost as if I had to be older, I had to be a wife and a mother, I had to have some distance from that space in order to do, and maybe I had to have written 8 novels before that to be a good enough writer to tell the story well. And so that's where The Hollows first showed up. And, you know, my brother's always like, oh, you know, that's where we grew up. That's the town where we grew up. That's what The Hollows is. I was like, well, you know, yes and no, not at all. I mean, no.
Well, it's a little bit, it's a little bit more like Stephen King's Castle Rock.
Yeah. It's not exactly the town where we grew up. But I get what he's saying. Like, I get where, you know, like some of that stuff kind of came forward into the town. And I, you know, and then as the stories continued, I kind of stayed in The Hollows, and it became less of a place and more of a character. I started to have an energy, you know, I started to sense that it had an agenda, you know, that it wanted something. It didn't like secrets, and it encouraged paths to cross. And it started to kind of take on a life of its own. So I, you know, was writing these books, and then there's a character who shows up also at the end of Fragile. Her name is Eloise Montgomery.
Oh, I like her. She's a reluctant psychic, you know, like,
yeah,
okay.
She's like, oh no, what's this? And, you know, and I thought when she first turned up in Fragile, I was like, ooh, you know, a psychic, that's exciting. You know, what, even if she's a fraud, you know, that's still interesting. You know, so I was kind of excited about her, and then she wound up at Fragile. I mean, she has a big part, but it's a small, you know, she doesn't have a lot of pages in the book. So I was kind of disappointed, and I kind of kept thinking about her and Joan Cooper, and then that, you know, naturally flowed into the following book, which was Darkness, My Old Friend. But then Eloise, you know, Eloise has this kind of rich story, this rich life, and my agent was like, I need, you know, I want more about just Eloise, you know, like I just need to know more about her as a character. You know, why don't we just, you know, why don't you do a short story? And I was like, okay. And so, you know, because I too have been like, you know, I've been writing about her, you know, and she has roles in a number of different books. You know, my books are not really series, but they kind of chain link to each other. And, you know, I wanted to spend more time with her too. I wanted to understand her better as well. So I wound up writing a short story that turned into a novella, or a short story that turned into 3 short stories that actually is a novella told in 3 parts that spans 30 years. And, you know, so it started off as one thing, and then, you know, like all sort of fictional adventures, it turned into something else. So, you know, that's how I wound up doing the novella and the short stories. And I do enjoy that short form as well, but I tend to, my truest voice as a writer is the novel, because, you know, I need all those pages. I need all those words to get to all my layers of, you know, the people in my, you know, in my books.
How long does it take you to write a novel?
I generally do a first draft in 9 to 12 months. And then I'll sit with it for a while, you know, a week or 2 weeks, let it just sit there, and then go back to page one and do another draft and then another. And then eventually I turn it in, because I'll be like butting up against my deadline. I'll turn it in, and then, you know, my editor will read it and it'll come back to me with her thoughts. And then I'll do another draft, and then probably another draft. And then there are like two or three or four more proofreading drafts. So it's another year. It's usually a year between you turn it in, and then it's usually a year before it publishes. So there's another year of, you know, editing and writing and rewriting and all that. Meanwhile, you're writing the next one. So it's, you know, it's kind of an ongoing process of vision and revision.
It is. I was telling, I speak at writers' conferences and writers' events, and somebody will come up to me and said, "Oh, I'm done. I finished. I'm ready. I'm ready to send it off." And I'm, "Oh boy, I think it's not going to work like that."
Yeah. I know. I think it's funny. You know, so many people think that, you know, oh, you just write it and it's done. You know, but I haven't met an author yet that doesn't need an editor. I certainly don't count myself as one of those authors. I know some authors don't think they need an editor, but I haven't met one yet.
When you were in the publishing business, because you worked actually in the publishing business, were you on the editing side, the publicity side? What part of the publishing world were you in?
I was on the publicity side, and it's, you know, I went to NYU and then to the New School. You know, and all I really wanted to do was write, but I thought, you know, I never really thought that I could do it or that I could make my living, mainly because, you know, that's what my dad told me. He was like, "Hey, look, it's great that you can, you know, string a few coherent sentences together, but you need to get a job. You know, after you graduate, please do not move home to write your first novel. You know, do not travel around Europe to find yourself. Go to work. You know, get a paycheck."
Oh, gee. Now that sounds like my dad.
Yeah.
my dad said the same thing. Do not travel around Europe.
Right.
And any particularly, and don't you dare dress like a bum and with torn jeans. I actually didn't listen to him, and I traveled to Europe, and I bought a house in England, which so, you know. But sometimes things turn out okay.
Yeah, they turn out okay, and your dad's like, "Oh, you know, that's fine." But, you know, so I went into publishing just because I thought, well, you know, this is the closest I'm going to get to that dream. You know, like I was like, this is the closest I can get to that dream without actually committing myself to that dream. So I went into publicity, which is, you know, for a 20-year-old, a publicity job in New York City is pretty sweet. You know, I mean, it's parties and travel and, you know, placing authors in the media and doing all that stuff. And unfortunately for me, I happened to be, you know, really good at my job. And so my job kept just getting bigger and bigger. And then the time I spent writing just kept getting smaller and smaller, until I reached a point in my life where I wasn't writing at all. And I had a moment, like an epiphany, where I realized everything in my life is wrong. You know, I'm with the wrong guy, you know, at the time I was. And I'm, you know, I'm devoting 110% of myself to a job that I, you know, don't love. And that the only thing I've ever wanted to do, I'm letting it just slowly fade to nothing. So I figured in that moment, I was like, okay, I can live with, you know, spectacular crash and burn failure, but, you know, I'm not going to be able to live with a, you know, fade to black. So
a trip to Florida.
Well, you know, yeah, eventually the trip to Florida, but first, you know, a year and a half of finishing the book that I started when I was 19 years old. I started my first novel when I was 19 and I was still in college. And then I let it sit. And so I went back to it and I finished it. And I was 29 when I finished it. And it was a few months later that I went down to Key West and met my husband. Well, and that was the first novel I published.
And it turned out pretty good all the way around.
It turned out okay. So far, so good.
Now, back to that publishing job, though. Did you get to travel with some interesting people?
I did. I did a lot of, you know, a lot of dinners, a lot of traveling. I did a lot of, you know, traveling to conferences. I think probably my favorite person that I worked with was William Gibson. He was one of my favorite writers before I met him, and he's just, like, sort of one of my favorite people. So that was one of the most exciting people that I worked with. But we worked with, a wide range of authors.
Well, of all, you know, being in the publishing world also, you could take the task realistically of getting an agent
right.
and getting yourself published once you were at that point. Because for people who have no experience, it is a rather mysterious world up there in New York City.
It is. It's a mysterious world. And, you know, and I guess I think in a lot of ways, those 10 years was kind of my education. I mean, I worked in publishing for almost 10 years. And in a lot of ways, that was my education. And I learned a lot. It didn't necessarily help me get published. I worked at Penguin Putnam, and they did not publish my first book. In fact, they turned it down. And I think, though, what I learned from working in publishing, you know, is sort of multifold. First of all, you know, it's a job. It's a real job. Most of us start at the bottom. Most of us start with small publishing contracts and we work our way, hopefully, you know, to the middle or the top or something, right? So you know, it's a job. So I walked in knowing that. I walked in knowing that a publishing contract is not a windfall. It's not an end. It's a beginning. It's an open door. It's a gateway, if you're lucky, to the writing life. And that writing, the story, the characters, the digging deeper, the getting better all the time, that should always and forever be your most important goal, that you never stop thinking about the writing, the words on the page, because that is everything. And I knew that walking in. You know, I knew that if I wanted to succeed, it's hard to get your book published. It's harder to succeed as a published writer. So if you want it bad enough, you know, you roll up your sleeves and you get to work and you check your ego at the door.
And you do work hard because
it's
not just the writing, it's all the follow-up and all the things that go into it. Now, right now for this book, are you doing a tour?
I have been on the road for The Red Hunter. I actually just had my last appearance toward the end of July. So I was on the road for The Red Hunter for a couple months on and off. And I just turned in my next novel. So now we're sort of, you know, I'm, you know, going to be at work, at my desk, you know, doing the book that comes next.
Well, I have a feeling this one's going to hit the New York Times bestselling list because...
Well, thank you.
You know, you really got some great blurbs, not just from Ace, but from Tammy Hoag and Sandra Brown, and they all love it. And now, the first time you hit the New York Times bestselling list, what was it like? What did you do that day?
You know, it was funny. I mean, it's huge. It's a huge thing. You know, it's like sort of a pinnacle. But, you know, at the time, I also had a four-month-old baby.
So you weren't doing cartwheels?
I was.
You did?
I was just carrying a baby at the same time.
Yeah.
I honestly, it's huge. Every time, you know, the book's on the bestseller list, it's a big deal. You know, I'm definitely not on there every single time, but, you know, all the books do very well. And I'm, you know, feel really grateful for that. And it's a big deal to be on that bestseller list. But honestly, the days that were bigger were smaller, if that makes any sense. Like, for example, you know, after I had sort of, you know, graduated from college and went to work in, you know, publicity, I was hustling all the time trying to write. You know, I was writing, working on, you know, one thing or another, you know, trying to work on the novel, forgetting about the novel, and then trying to write articles and stuff. So I lived in the Bronx, with a town called River, a little area called Riverdale. And there was a newspaper up there called the Riverdale Press. It's just a really small but well-regarded newspaper. And so every week I hassled this editor. You know, I want to write something, I want to write something. Here's my clips from college. Here's what I've done. This is what I do. You know, here's some writing samples. So every week I just would, you know, nag this guy. And I think eventually he just got so sick of me. I mean, literally it was 6 months of just going, can I write something? Can I write something? And he just got so sick of me. And he was like, you know what? Yes. Oh, God. Okay. Here's an assignment. You know, just go do, you know, cover this. So I wrote, so I covered, I'm like living in the Bronx, and like I covered the first Seder dinner for a group of Russian Jewish immigrants, their first Seder dinner in the U.S. So I wrote an article about it, and it wound up, you know, on the, it was called the second first page, which was like where they had their big feature, you know, their news feature. And I was like, you know, I walked into like a deli on Broadway and was able to buy this paper. When I opened the paper, there was my name. And that was huge. That was huge because I thought, oh, my God, I can do this. I can do this. I'm going to do this. I'm doing it. And that moment was in some ways, I mean, not in any way diminish the accomplishment of, you know, hitting the New York Times bestseller list or any bestseller list. But that was really big because it was about, you know, tenacity, you know, bravery, doing something that I had never done before, and just finally feeling like I had permission from kind of the universe to, like, you know, if you want to do this, you can do it.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. I love that.
Thank you.
That's nice. So, what is your, you have a nice webpage. What is the webpage?
LisaUnger.com.
That's it. It's simple. And yep. People can go there, and I know that there, you have some interesting information. Now, also one of the big things that happens now in a writer's life is when you get your wiki page, and you're on Wikipedia, and it sort of makes you like, oh, a real person, a real writer there.
A real person.
My goodness.
Are the little check marks next to your name and social media, right, that says you're verified as a public figure or whatever, like on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, you get a little check mark.
Exactly. Now, you have a few events coming up that where people can meet you?
Yes. I will be speaking for the Four Seasons Writer Series, which benefits the Friends of the Library, and that information is on my website. There's a link that you can sign up, and that's next Friday, the 8th. And then I'm also going to be at the Tampa Bay Festival of Reading, my hometown festival, my very, very favorite, one of my very favorite places to be and meet readers. I've been doing that every year for, I don't even know how long now, like so long.
Well, readers love to meet authors, and I think it's this whole thing of being able to take selfies with an author. I had an author on who she had just started. She wrote a romance, and she happened to she was at one of these book signing events, and a young woman came up and said, could I have a selfie? And of course she had a selfie, and it was all, you know, smiles and nice. But this woman put it out on her social media, and it turned out that this woman was connected to like every military woman in the United States because she had served in Iraq. And so all this selfie went to all of the women in the armed forces, and in no time, this woman was selling books to, she had all these fans, and all these books were being sold. Many, of course, the people were in Iraq or in Afghanistan at the time. And she was so thrilled. She was getting emails from people who were in Afghanistan, you know, in the middle of you know, their life is on the line, but they have these downtimes, and they were reading her on Kindle. And it all came, and she had never thought to promote her books to the military. I mean, it hadn't occurred to her. And but it looks like, you know, when they're out there, they need something to read, and they love to read. And wow, it was a wonderful thing, and the fans appreciate it. The fans,
And I love being, you know, the festival, Kansas Daytime Festival, which is funny. So I think after my first book. Which published in 2002. So it was either 2002 or maybe it was 2003. I spoke there with Karen Slaughter, who's one of my good friends and one of my favorite writers, and Laura Lippman, another of my favorite writers. We spoke together on a panel, and we were the opening act for Mary Higgins Clark. And it was like, you know, completely packed room. Of course, everyone was there to see Mary. they had to listen to us first. And, you know, there have been so many experiences like that, you know, at the Times Festival. And then a couple of years ago, I had the honor at the Times Festival of interviewing Judy Blume on stage. And that was a huge, obviously a huge joy and, you know, honor for me to share a stage with her and talk to her and, you know, do all that. So I've been doing the Times Festival forever, and I just love meeting readers, and ACE comes down for that every year, and a lot of, you know, writer pals of mine come every year for that, and it's, you know, just a great event. And the Four Seasons Author Series is also really, really neat as well. They do a beautiful, beautiful event there. And there's a link on my website where you can sign up for that as well.
Okay. Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. It's been a joy for me to talk to you.
And me too. Thank you for having me.
As I said to everyone, the fact that you are really one of these authors who has depth, and all of your characters are like 27 layers, a real perfect cake. And The Red Hunter is particularly good. And I hope that people will go out there and get the book. And I know that you already have many, many wonderful reviews on Amazon. And it just, you know, it's just an amazing book. So thank you so much for coming on the program today, Lisa. And I'll look forward to when the next book comes out, and you'll come back on, okay?
I will, for sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow. Okay. Well, Lisa is really an amazing woman. It's hard to, she's written so much in such a really, actually a short time too, and just an amazing author. I was going to tell everyone that next week on Tuesday, Bill Larson is going to be in the studio, and he has a couple of recent developments in the law that he's going to talk about. And if you have a question, you can send me an email at patsy.radio@gmail.com, and he will answer your questions. There are many, some things happening with ebooks that will be of interest to all of you people who have your ebooks out there, and there's talk about where royalties are going to be coming from, and also the problem of piracy of ebooks. So I think that this is going to be an interesting time to talk to Bill. So I hope that you'll join me then. And the following week, I'm going to have Ace Atkins on. I'm also going to have Nelson DeMille. So I have a big lineup of people coming on in September. And I want, again, to remind everyone, we're going to end, I'm going to tell Big Ed in the control room that we'll end with the Texas, Eyes of Texas song today, because, again, as I said, my nephew is in Victoria, Texas. They were spared a little bit because the storm was actually supposed to hit Victoria, and it veered to the east and hit Houston and all parts around there. But it is such a tragedy, and everybody who, you know, if you can donate something, please do so. And as I said, the ones that that I heard about that were working the best over there were Red Cross and Samaritan's Purse. So fine, but make sure if you are donating, check out your charities and also some of the ones for animal shelters, because they have also faced a terrible and horrendous amount of tragedy with the animals that have been lost. So please make sure that you donate to them. And then meanwhile, I just want to tell everyone that, you know, as Lisa said, she had to get serious one day and say, I have a book in me. I started a book and I'm going to finish it. And so she decided to do it, and she did it in great fashion. And look where she is today. I think she's must be in the 3-4, maybe more million books. And she has done it. I will say one thing about it. If you want to see somebody who's really improved from her very first book to today, the new book is absolutely amazing. And it is sometimes just wonderful to read an author from the beginning and see the development of their talent. Anyway, I want to just remind everybody that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So take some time this weekend to read and to write and to dream. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. This is Patsy with a Z. Hoping you'll say something nice to someone, and I will say something nice to Big Ed, who is going to pull up the Texas song, and we're going to close with that so that all of you are thinking about Texas and praying for everybody there. And I lived in Texas for a long time, and the people are amazing and resilient, but they need your prayers. Bye. Have a great weekend.
The stars at night are big and bright. Deep in the heart of Texas, the prairie sky is wide and high. Deep in the heart of Texas, the sage in bloom is like perfume. Deep in the heart of Texas reminds me of the one I love. Deep in the heart of Texas. In the heart of Texas, the cowboys cry, "Yippee-yi!" Deep in the heart of Texas, the doggies bawl. Deep in the heart of Texas, deep in the heart.